As viruses multiply, they can mutate. And now there's a growing body of research that suggests an early mutation made the coronavirus more contagious and difficult to stop. We're exploring what mutation means for infection, transmission, virus development. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, what do you want to know about how RNA viruses mutate? What questions do you have about the variant in Wuhan, China, as compared to other parts of the world? It's 800-642-1234. Emily Bruce is a faculty scientist in virology at the University of Vermont's Lerner College of Medicine. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, happy to be here.
So RNA viruses, like the flu and measles, they're more prone to changes and mutations compared to DNA viruses. The coronavirus being an RNA virus, are we dealing with mutations here?
So we are dealing with mutations. And the important thing to keep in mind is that that's a normal thing for RNA viruses. Because of the way they replicate their genetic material, they're not as good at catching errors that happen in that process as, say, the cells in our body are, that have a whole set of specialized machinery that looks for errors that are made when you're copying that material and has the ability to correct them. And so, as a whole, RNA viruses mostly lack the ability to fix those kinds of typos. The coronaviruses are actually a bit of an exception in that they do have some ability to fix that kind of error, but still on the whole, they're an RNA virus, and so they can, just as a normal kind of course of doing business, develop small errors that get perpetuated in each cycle of replication. And because they replicate in an exponential fashion, so each virus that infects a cell will go on to make thousands of new virus particles, you can accumulate those kinds of errors relatively rapidly, just because you're making so many new viruses each time.
Yeah, so once an RNA virus makes contact with its host, it starts to make new copies of itself, and that can go on, you know, to infect other cells. What happens when a virus mutates? What is going on within that virus?
So it's kind of like if you make a typo when you're writing something in Word, and let's say you have the spell check function turned off. So sometimes that typo isn't really important at all. You have an extra space in between your words, and it doesn't really change your message at all, and most people wouldn't even pick up that it's there. Lots of mutations that happen are like that. They don't have any functional effect on the virus. And then sometimes you could think that you might make a change when you're typing that makes a little bit of a change, and someone could notice, you know, a word is spelled wrong, but people still understand your meaning, and it doesn't change your message at all. And those are the common kinds of changes. But then occasionally, you could have a change that really changes the whole meaning of your message. If you misspelled an important word and made it into a different word, and you changed the whole meaning of the phrase. And so you can see kind of if you see about, like, if you're writing those things down in your normal typing software, you can see that last kind of error, again, is going to be the most rare. But again, that's the kind that we're most concerned about, where you have a change that, in the case of the virus, this would be something that makes a significant biological change and isn't the equivalent of a typo or an extra space in your words.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. So there was a mutation in the coronavirus early on in the course of the pandemic. What do you know about this mutation? Did it make it easier to spread the virus from person to person?
So this was a mutation, D614G, that people noticed early on in the pandemic, and particularly they noticed in sequencing data from different places that this was becoming a much more frequent change that was being seen. And because scientists on a whole are really quite a cautious lot, for a long time people weren't necessarily convinced that they were seeing it more often because it was actually more transmissible, because there's other reasons you could see that. And so early on in the summer, you know, the other reason that people thought could be at play is simply something that we would call a founder effect, where the first person to fly to a new area and start a new outbreak kind of by chance, because they were the first person who got on a plane to that particular city, maybe they had this one typo. And because of the fact that they were in the right place at the right time, that would then be in all the viruses that propagated from that point onwards. And so those kinds of things can happen too. And really, it wasn't until we got a lot of different lines of biological evidence that started to indicate that this mutation actually does increase transmissibility that I think most of the people in the field came to the conclusion that this was a change that did actually have biological effect. And one of the most convincing experiments in support of that was a really elegant piece of work done by Ralph Barrick's group. And they're longtime coronavirus experts far before this pandemic started. But they used a technique called reverse genetics, where they made a virus that had only that mutation changed. So they had the what we call the wild type virus, or the parental strain that was circulating. And then they made a single change at that exact spot. And then they took the pair of those viruses. So they have a really nicely controlled system. And they put them both into pairs of hamsters. And the way they set this experiment up, the hamsters were in cages that were next to each other. So there was airflow in between them, but the hamsters couldn't touch each other. And they looked to see if the hamster that was infected was able to transmit virus to the pair in the neighboring cage. And they saw that none of the pairs that were infected with wild type virus transmitted virus to their neighbor, but five of the eight pairs that had the 614G mutant were able to transmit. And so that's the kind of evidence that does really indicate that the virus with that mutation does have a leg up in transmitting through that kind of route.
We're talking with Emily Bruce, who's a faculty scientist at the University of Vermont. We're looking at virus mutation and what it means for how we approach the coronavirus pandemic. You can join in with your questions about how viruses mutate. What do you want to know about the D614G? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Emily, is it surprising that the coronavirus mutated in such a way that it became more transmissible? Or isn't that not too significant upon itself?
So it's not terribly surprising, because when you think about it, viruses introduce lots of these kinds of changes, and the ones that have changes that make it easier for the virus to spread from cell to cell or spread from animal to animal will be the ones that are selected for, and that's kind of natural selection at work. The ones that are fittest will have a better chance of going on and propagating in the next host. So that on its own isn't terribly surprising, in that is kind of what viruses do. That's what that's their MO.
Yeah.
But the other thing I think it's important to mention, I wanted to put in here, was that while this mutation makes the virus slightly more transmissible, it's not the reason why the pandemic is the way it is, because all of the precautions that work against the parental strain of SARS-CoV-2 also work against this mutation. So it doesn't mean that the virus can escape around masks, or that it can survive hand washing measures, or that it can transmit, you know, through great distances outside. It gives it a little bit of advantage in closed indoor situations where people aren't masked and there's a lot of people in a closed space. And that's what all the, you know, strains of this virus like. But all the precautions that that we've been recommending against the original strain, they all still work. And so this is still something that is totally handleable. It's just all of the same measures in place.
The coronavirus will continue to change. We're learning about virus mutation with University of Vermont virologist Emily Bruce. What questions do you have about gauging a virus's transmissibility? Are you concerned that a COVID vaccine can keep up with the virus mutating? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Emily Bruce here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about coronavirus mutations and how scientists study and evaluate their effect on the nature of this pandemic. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One thing that will drive the future of the COVID-19 pandemic is how the virus evolves. And recently, scientists discovered evidence that the virus evolved to be slightly more transmissible early on. What questions do you have about virus mutation? What about the virus jumping to bats or other animal hosts? It's 800-642-1234. We have University of Vermont faculty scientist Emily Bruce is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Franco is with us from Oxford. Hi, Franco.
Hi, good morning, Kate and Emily. My question for Emily is, it's rather a simple one, but I never really was sure. As a virus such as the coronavirus spreads through the communities and out the world, throughout the world, does it get less and less weak as weaker or weaker? Like, it gets less and less deadly as it goes on and on before a vaccine? God bless it.
Mm-hmm.
Good question, Franco.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there isn't necessarily a hard and fast rule because it's kind of, it's predicting how evolution is at play. And basically, viruses don't have, you know, they're not thinking, but if you think about it in that kind of way, you know, what they want to do is they want to make more copies of themselves and they want those copies to go on and be successful. And so successful for a virus is simply that more copies are being made and they're being propagated. It's not necessarily, the virus doesn't, you know, it doesn't have intentional malice where it's like better if it makes people sick. It actually, in many cases, is more successful if it's able to spread without causing really severe disease, because that means that people are still up and about and going to work and going to school and they're not lying on the couch.
They're spreading it more.
Exactly. And that is one of the things I think that actually has made this virus so successful at spreading as a pandemic, is that people are at their most infectious before they're symptomatic. And so before people realize they're sick is when they're spreading the most amount of virus. And that is one of the things that has made it just so hard to control. Fortunately, though, there isn't any rule that, as viruses mutate and spread throughout the community, they become more dangerous. And so fortunately, that isn't something that we've seen happen here.
Franco, thanks. Let's bring in Andrew now from Eagle. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. What is your question about virus mutation?
So I had seen an interview with Dr. Francis Boyle earlier this year, and he was talking about gain-of-function viruses. And I was curious, with the rate of mutations that this virus has had, do you believe that there is some sort of gain-of-function built into this virus, and that's why the mutation rate is so high?
So I guess I would want to define what you mean by gain-of-function more precisely, because I'm not sure that I understood fully. I think, to answer a first part, and I'm kind of guessing here, there isn't anything engineered in this virus that makes it acquire mutations more quickly or become more dangerous more quickly. Gain of function is also a specific term that virologists often use when they're referring to testing a mutation by making that change with a system called reverse genetics, where we make a change and there's a specific set of oversight that looks at if you're making a mutation to a virus that is suspected to cause a gain of function and to make that virus more transmissible or more deadly. And there's additional special oversight about making those mutations and deciding on whether they should be made and how they should be handled for biosafety reasons, and also the publication of that information. So I think it's one of those terms that might mean different things to different people. There's nothing engineered. There's no evidence that there was anything engineer that this is anything other than a naturally arising virus that's acquiring mutations at the rate that we would expect it to.
An alarming development last month and earlier on in the pandemic was the transmission to mink and animals. What do you see there?
So there, I think, I'm not fully caught up on the entire story. I know essentially the worry is that if the virus transmits to another mammal host, that it can develop different mutations that might make it more dangerous and more transmissible. And coronaviruses can transmit into multiple other kind of intermediate species, whether that is kind of a dead-end host where, you know, the lion at the Bronx Zoo got infected, but that lion was probably not going on to infect, you know, everyone at the zoo, or whether it's something where you can have a lot of changes occurring more rapidly, is something that you need more research to work out. I think clearly in that case, they were concerned about that happening, and that's why a large number of mink were culled. But it's something we have to kind of constantly evaluate.
We're talking with Emily Bruce, who's a faculty scientist at the University of Vermont. We're looking at virus mutation and vaccine development with you at 800-642-1234. Emily, let's look at the COVID-19 vaccine horizon here. Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines are both mRNA vaccines. This is relatively new technology. How does it work?
So it essentially works by giving your body the instructions to make a protein that is found on the outside of the virus particle. And so it's called the spike protein, and it's kind of the equivalent of the key that gets the virus into a lock on the surface of a cell to be able to get inside and infect. And so the way vaccines work is often by targeting that outside protein, because it's the first thing that the body will see. And so if you essentially show a picture of that protein to your body, the same way that Hagrid taught the castle doors at Hogwarts to recognize Sirius Black by showing them a picture.
I love your analogies.
Yeah, where you give your body kind of a warning and show it a picture, and you're like, all right, if you see this, you need to kick into gear and, you know, fire up your whole immune system so you can go get it. And so that's the general principle of vaccines. The way that mRNA vaccines are different is just that instead of having to make the proteins or make the virus and inactivate it, you can simply give the body the string of letters that lets it make the protein on its own. So the mRNA is the message that's translated to make the protein. And by giving just that message and not having to make all of the protein, they're much, much faster to design and they're much, much faster to make. And so that's just basically the difference, is that you can design vaccines much more quickly. We had the sequence for this in the middle of January, and they were able to pick the piece that they should be targeting and get the vaccine designed and start working on it in a matter of days.
Yeah, these vaccines were created in record-breaking time, as you say, less than a year. What are the factors that make that possible?
So the biggest factor that makes that possible is that money was no limit. And so all of the things that are normally very expensive and risky steps in developing a vaccine, you normally don't do those all at once, because you don't have the money to commit to doing every possible thing. So let's say you're trying a bunch of different ways of making vaccines, and they all need different factories and they all need different production lines. Normally, you'd wait to see which of your vaccines worked best, and then you would make a factory that was able to use that technology. But that's what we did here was different. We just basically paid up front to do all of the kinds of manufacturing lines that you would need, and also to do all of the logistics and the coordination of clinical trials simultaneously with many, many people at once everywhere. So it's not that the science part of it was rushed. It's that we were able to do all of the logistics and all of the manufacturing capabilities, and all of that was just scaled up massively and at a potential loss for investing money in a factory that might not be needed, rather than really anything being rushed in the way the science was done.
Yeah, so basically opening up the coffers, doing anything at any cost to get this vaccine to market. You study viruses. That's, you know, your life work. How has the pandemic looked from your vantage point as a scientist?
Oh, that's a tough question. Well, it's hard because you hoped it wouldn't be this bad, because we knew what to do is the hard thing. Mm-hmm. It's been really hard as a virologist to watch all of the numbers and what's happening to the healthcare workers and just to everybody in every facet of life. When, I mean, you always knew as a virologist that there could be a pandemic and it could be really bad. But I have to say, I didn't predict that we would elect as a country not to use the simplest, easiest measures uniformly. The idea that, you know, we could all wear masks and that would cut transmission hugely. I think the thing that was so surprising was just that people, there didn't seem to be a good communication or understanding that we're all in this together. And that when you decide to take a risk and to go to a bar, to not wear a mask, you're not just risking your own health. You can say, well, I'm happy to take that risk and I'm young and I think that I'll be fine. And statistically, you will be, though the long COVID symptoms are nothing to sneer at. But you're not just gambling your own life. You're gambling on your kid's kindergarten teacher, and you're gambling on your dentist mother that they live with, and you're gambling on the immunocompromised kid of your classmate.
And Emily, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Emily Bruce, faculty scientist at the University of Vermont. News Update is next.